Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Breaking Point Podcast. Today we are here with Sarah Louise Ryan. Do I need to say Sarah Louise or can I just say Sarah?
Just say Sarah.
What would you rather?
Sarah.
You just say Sarah, okay. Mm. My mum's name is Sarah and her middle name is Louise, so I was like, that's quite ironic, isn't it? So she's a Sarah Louise as well. Anyway, right, Sarah is a dating coach and I'm very thankful for her speaking to me because she's clearly very busy. And yes, we are just going to have a discussion about, well, I've done some questions, but I think we'll try and make it as sort of free-flowing as possible because I think that's where we'll get the best conversation. So Sarah, do you want to introduce yourself and say whatever it is that you feel is necessary to say to start this thing off?
Yeah, under pressure. Hi, everyone tuning in.
No pressure.
Listening in. I'm Sarah. I'm an international matchmaker. I've just qualified as a couples therapist and I've been helping singles find, build and reconnect to dating and relationships since 2011. I've got a couple of dating agencies. One of them operates internationally and the other one is based in the UK and is based on sexual, emotional and intellectual compatibility. And I work with a handful of coaching clients, singles and couples on a weekly basis. So this is actually, I know you say busy, but this is actually the busiest time of year. And you probably wouldn't think it in terms of trends in the dating and relating space. You probably think Valentine's Day or Christmas, but actually there's something ingrained in us, which is a back to school mentality come the beginning of September, which is when we're recording. Actually, it's the first day, isn't it? And
yes.
Yeah, I think it's ingrained in us to kind of like take stock of anything that we didn't achieve in the year so far. And so at the beginning of September, we receive so many inquiries because people think, oh, you know, summer fun, summer flings are over and now I'm looking for love. And people often want to actualize it before Christmas, you know, the age-old cuffing season. So September sees me and the team super busy. We just did an event for 100 people yesterday. It's like mind-blowing. So that's a bit about me.
Wow.
You'll probably see me in another 10 years in the dating and relating space because I just love helping people find it, couples reconnect in it, and people figure out why they didn't keep it. So that's where I'm at. What I do.
So you are the real deal, aren't you? That's quite a hell of a resume you've got behind you. Why did you or how did you get into this industry in the first place?
Yeah, really good question, because you don't often see recruiters searching for matchmakers and whatnot. You don't often hear
that. No, it's very interesting.
Yeah. So I'm Northern, very chatty, obsessed with people and getting to know them. And I think it's something that's ingrained in almost the Northern culture. But that aside, I studied psychology and also have a degree in international marketing. And when I finished university, I moved to London and I started working in a really great job, but it was really product orientated. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've done all this slogging and learning for this. And I was like, so unsure then what to do. And actually, I call it fate. I don't usually believe too much in it, but for me, it was on that day. Saw a little ad, like age-old Google ads, not the way they are now. It used to be tiny little thumbnails in the corner of your screen. People probably pay 5p for them or whatever. And it said, yeah, junior matchmaker sought for a Mayfair dating agency. And I was like, what? People get paid to put people together on dates. I'm the girl for that job. And so I just checked it out. Like, I thought that dating agencies were culture or religion based and marriage bureaus, basically, predominantly in the likes of the Jewish community or in India. And when I saw that, like, the modern world of dating actually use dating agencies and they're no longer called marriage bureaus, I was like, oh my goodness. So I checked it out and I called the owner of that dating agency in 2011. I was like, I guarantee I'm the girl for the job. I don't know what qualifications you need, but that's just me. And actually, you know, moreover, receiving CVs, the person that owned the dating agency was like, absolutely, come and have a chat. And the rest is history. You know, I kind of worked in-house at that dating agency in Mayfair, franchising and running hundreds of events, and then literally old school, running around London with a little black book, making notes of pilots, doctors, lawyers, solicitors. I was in my early 20s. What do they want in love? What hasn't worked for them so far? What do they know about themselves now? And who do they want to meet? And it was the funnest job, and it still is. And now I've got an office in London and also in Manchester, running my two dating agencies. But the kind of bridge between working there and running my own now in 2023 is that I was headhunted to take over and run an international dating agency by somebody Wow. that owned it and no longer wanted to run it back in 2014. So I was like in the States, living there, living in London, had 25 matchmakers all over the world in my mid-20s, helping people all over the world find love. It's just been the most incredible journey. That's how I found the job. Hired myself.
Wow, that's amazing. And based on the small interactions I've had, I can definitely see you being very good at that and a very trustworthy and calming force for promoting people to engage and find people. So that's a very convoluted way of saying it, but you sort of understand what I mean. So when you say you were running around London with a little black book, what does that mean? Writing things down and what people were looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I sat in quite a lot of consultations from other matchmakers that have been doing it for years to kind of figure out how do they get to know people on a deeper level. And way back then, I mean, I say it because it really has been like 12 years, matchmakers had a handful of business models and they weren't very complex, where they would show profiles, invite people to their offices and say, who do you want to meet? But that was kind of like an on-paper version of Tinder for some matchmaking agencies, letting people choose their own matches. And it's a model that I really didn't understand. Why would they come to a matchmaker if they're choosing their own matches? So I kind of understood a little bit about how other matchmakers worked, how this dating agency worked. And really, it was sitting down with another human being one-to-one for about an hour and a half on an initial conversation, just to have a normal conversation about how dating is going for them, what isn't working for them, who is it that they would like to meet, and how well do they actually know themselves? Like, what have they learned from previous? I mean, I wasn't really trained to ask that, but I'm nosy. I wanted to know so much about, well, what didn't work for you so far? Yeah, of course, I'm so nosy. It's probably why I'm very good at my job, really. I'll call it natural curiosity. Northerners are just saying nosy. Basically, what didn't work so far and why are you single? I mean, not that there's anything wrong with it. There's so many people that choose to be, but if you're coming to a matchmaker, you don't choose to be single. So what is it that was holding them back from finding that deep and fulfilling connection? And was it something that they were doing and did they know? Did they have a feeling that it was something that was going on for them, but they weren't getting the accountability and feedback from their online dates, which is still the case today with all the swiping apps? And so just having a really meaningful conversation and then getting to grips with, well, do you want to build a family? Do you believe in marriage? If you've been married, do you want to get married again? What, tell me about your religiosity. You know, I've specialized in lots of niches. Like right now, my niche in the UK is finding compatible singles based on their sexual wants, needs and desires, because I found over the last 12 years matchmakers will not touch let alone, you know, sexual desire, libido. They won't even talk about frequency in which people want to be intimate. But I truly believe that when you choose your person and they choose you, that physical intimacy, attraction and connection alongside the emotional vulnerability and similar wants, values and goals is what sets us apart in those deep romantic relationships, aside from other relationships, you know, friendships, it's like, well, if you're not going to, if someone's going to pay you £10,000 to find their partner, which is an average cost for a matchmaker, surely you're going to talk about sex. Why not? Mm. So I'm still the only matchmaker talking about it. So that's where I'm at. That's what I'm doing at the moment.
So you mentioned it briefly. You spoke about dating apps, a big sort of topic. How have they impacted what you do, and how have they impacted dating in general, in your opinion?
Oh my gosh. Well, I guess because
big question.
And I think it's a big question for me to answer. And the reason is because I'm long in the tooth in the dating industry. So I've seen a lot of trends, and I've seen ups and downs and the effects of traditional matchmaking, which is what I do with the modern twist of talking about emotion and sexuality. If I was in the dating game as a matchmaker for a year, I'd probably just say dating apps keep us busy because people are burnt out. But actually, it's not emotionally, I mean, and, you know, through swiping relentlessly in the paradox of choice. But over the last decade, I've seen so many people go to dating apps that matchmakers have not been busy, or matchmaking then only becomes for the elite because they are time poor and have high disposable income. I've then seen people get so overwhelmed with dating apps because they're not sure how to navigate them and the feelings that come up with regards to rejection and things like that, which we'll talk about a bit later, hopefully, about what's going on right now. And so I've seen peaks and troughs in my offline space as a matchmaker and dating coach. Right now, I'm busier than ever, dare I say, in a post-pandemic world. And that is because we've kind of been allowed out again for the last like year and a half or two. And so during the pandemic, I wasn't super busy as a matchmaker, of course, because it was literally illegal for people to meet offline, but I was busy as a dating coach and people looking to reconnect in relationships. Now they're back out there dating again and swiping around, and they're experiencing the same feelings that they did, when I say they, I mean singles, 5 years ago and forgot about. It's almost like the muscle memory wasn't quite there. We'd had a long break from swiping and all of that jazz. So now I'm seeing the same emotional trend as I did 5 years ago. It's where singles have so many other singles at their fingertips. They feel like the grass is greener on the side of the other side of the next swipe. And the gamification of online dating has singles hooked into the process rather than meeting the people. They're, it's almost, dare I say, it's a big and heavy word, and, you know, don't sue me for it or whatever, but people are addicted to the game of dating, and it's just when it comes to apps. So they come to me because they're emotionally wiped out from all the swiping. They've invested a lot of time, money, and energy in meeting people, and the current stats are singles are spending anywhere on average between 10 and 15 hours a week swiping, and the conversion rate from swiping right and getting a successful online dating match to date is less than 1%. Wow.
Yeah, I wrote a blog post about online dating and Tinder in particular, because I found out that the guy that one of the co-founders of Tinder bought and then sold a mansion for £35 million. And I just thought that was so morally wrong, because in order to have achieved that level of success, you have to have brought such an incredible value to society. And the stats on Tinder just show the amount of sexless young adults, single young adults, has skyrocketed since the introduction of Tinder. And I compared it to, it's quite a controversial thing to compare it to, but I compared it to the opioid crisis and the Purdue Pharma the Purdue Pharma who put out OxyContin, and I said how they profited billions of pounds off of people, and they used the term, they used compassion as a way of pushing their medicine through because they said they wanted to help people, but really they knew what they were doing was wrong. And it's quite a stark comparison to make, but I feel like it's a very, very, a far softer version, obviously, of that phenomena, the what's going on with dating apps and how, you know, the advantage that women have on dating apps is quite, if you read the statistics about men swiping right to about 60% of women and women swiping right on about 5%, it speaks of the advantage that women have in the dating market that I think we're seeing played out nowadays, and the tendency towards what I would call extreme hypergamy, which is what is I see playing out in a lot of, well, all you have to do is look at Instagram and go through the memes that are populating, and it's all sort of, you know, it's, yeah, that was a bit of a rant, but do you sort of, you understand what I mean about the, there's no, yeah, there's been nowhere near enough value.
It's really interesting. As you've been talking, I'm totally like glued to my screen and listening in. And I really noticed the terminology between, you know, our ebb and flow of conversation, what you're saying. I'm saying the words like investment. You're saying the words like value, market. And so I'm just hearing like how it's like a monetization process. It's almost like time investment, resources. And it's like dating is a commodity right now. And yeah,
this is what happened. What has happened is, I suppose, as a result of, it is capitalism, but it's not just a product of the right, of the politics, which is what's usually associated with capitalism. Progressively, they're stripping away aspects of humanity and selling it back to us. Because I'm convinced, I think dating apps are going to die in about 10, I give them, I want to say 5 years, but maybe 10 years. I don't know. It might even be less. It could be more. Hopefully it's not. So what they're doing is they're, if you don't pay a subscription, you're at such a disadvantage nowadays in my experience, and they play all these little tricks on us. So when you get into a new environment, they front load all the attractive people at the beginning so that they get you hooked on a little bit, and then you always come back. I mean, I don't know for this, I don't know these things for certain, but I feel like they're playing games on us in so many ways. I think so.
Even though you don't know for certain, I think, you know, it's a pretty good guess.
Yeah, I think it is, to be fair. They're treating us like we're a commodity, and they're not treating us as users. They're treating us as statistics.
It's very dehumanizing. There's got to be a reason why there aren't dating coaches ingrained in those apps to teach people how to connect, overcome rejection, how to great first date. These dating apps, they are so monetized, and I think they monetize off keeping single to keep, you know, the paradox of choice going. Because with all the profit that they make, and with the multi-billion pound industry that the dating industry is, those big players have got enough profit to reinvest in the likes of myself and other dating experts to come in app and offer advice, but a lot of them don't want to hear that.
Absolutely. I think we need to sort of, people make the unconscious assumption that the purpose of an app is whatever the purpose of the app is. Well, that's the top of the hierarchy, but that's not what's at the top of the hierarchy. What's at the top of the hierarchy is people using the app. So it goes people using the app and then the purpose of the app, where it should be the other way around. If you're truly interested in your customer, in your user base, it should be the other way around. It should be the purpose. So the purpose of Tinder should be to connect people. That's a dating app, but it's not. It's to get people using the app, and whatever ways they can get people using the app, everything else will have to be subjugated to that goal. And I think that that's what's going on. But you know, the review, I check the periodically the reviews of these apps, and they're on like the Play Store and stuff, and they're going down and down and down. So I think it's just a waiting game, really. Yeah, they're going down.
I agree. So I mean, we can only hope. I can get behind one dating app, and it's the one that I'm not going to say, but you know, I'm not here. It's not an ad. It's not as fun as people say.
It's a good point. It's like
that doesn't really work. It works one day a week, and that's really an advocate to get people offline and get them connected. And if I had like some sort of slogan, you know, I don't, but it would be something along the lines of get offline and get connected. There's got to be a reason that without really marketing, my dating agency gets 100 people at every one of our events. You know, it's like people are really seeing humanness now, or the lack of humanity.
Absolutely.
People swiping on profiles rather than people, and they want this in life, real human connection, where they can see someone's demeanor, feel their energy, check in on the vibe, because it absolutely doesn't lie, which you can't check in on dating apps. I think people have sunk too much time in, I guess, being alone, and we're in a global crisis of loneliness. People don't want to sit there swiping in their PJs any longer, because it's just adding to the feeling that they're experiencing.
Absolutely. Amazing. Yeah, it's it is. Let's park dating apps for the time being, because as you said, it's a heavy topic. Right, let me look at, so I've noticed the word conscious crop up quite a lot in your content. Why have you used the word conscious? Why is it so important?
It's really important because what I've noticed I attract as a dating coach or a matchmaker is that whoever you are, as people, you know, by people. And I think I do a lot of self-development. Mm. I'm a massive advocate for self-development as well. You know, training in psychotherapy and delivering this, I'll go into it, but like the conscious connection between couples is like, being awake, really seeing what's going on, seeing how you relate to yourself, how you relate to others. And so I've noticed that I really attract in my dating agencies and in my on my coaching roster, so to speak, really self-developing human beings that don't see self-development as a quick fix to hire a therapist for an hour and hope that they'll be done. They're like, wanting to learn more about themselves on an emotional level. They want to learn more about what does relating in 2023 really mean? What do, like, if we're going to be, because I'm a heterosexual matchmaker, only because I do so many levels of compatibility, I'm not yet at the growth point where I can diversify and be at that inclusive level that I'd like to be. So I've always worked with heterosexual singles. So for the sake of me giving the context to that, I'll refer to people that I work with as men and women, because that's how they identify. And so in this modern world, men want to know where women are able to provide for themselves financially, emotionally, have children on their own, and go about preserving fertility and traveling the world and all that. Men want to know how to relate better to women as society is becoming, I mean, we're still a long way to go, ever more equal. And the kind of people I work with are super successful. And that's just because they have come from a background where they've worked hard. They're not, you know, all like trust fund, you know, singles who seek love. They're people that have really grafted. They have invested in learning. They're like sponges. They want to know more about the world. the people around them, and they want more from life. And a byproduct of that is becoming more self-aware so they can have a more enjoyable and joyful dating journey. They don't just want to have a whole string of dates that are mediocre to then find their partner. They really want to have like a joyful time connecting with people that, okay, if there's no chemistry, they can see them as friends and they can see why we brought them together. And so I use this word conscious is because people want to learn the lessons about what didn't work out for them in the past. They want to learn how they can be better partners, better for themselves. And they also want to sexually explore themselves, give love to themselves, and figure out how they bring that to a partner, what they're into inside and outside the bedroom. I just call my clients, in a nutshell, aside from all of that stuff, zesty. They've got a lot going on. They give a lot to others. They give a lot to communities. They're really into philanthropy. And so I call that consciousness, being super duper awake to the world, to themselves, and to the people that they date and relate with. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. That was a very, very thorough answer. I like that. So just as you were talking, I was thinking, historically dating has been, well, not historically, but I don't know, 30 plus years ago and prior to that, it was more a case of the people in your town or workplace or friendship group that you would sort of date with. So there was a lesser pool to choose from. And then as we've progressed, we've opened up, you know, industries such as, you know, the one that you're in and online dating. And we're kind of at this middle ground possibly between, there's this program on Netflix called The One. Have you heard of it?
I'm going to confess that I do not watch reality TV shows based around love. And I can tell you all the reasons.
Oh, it's not reality. It's a television series where the plot is you take a DNA sample of yourself, you upload it, you send it off to a company, and they match make you with your perfect match based on everything that your DNA has to say. And they call it The One because that's what they sell it on, the notion of finding the one. And as obviously, as you can expect, there's an awful lot of controversy that surrounds the notion in the program that people exploit it and use it in different ways, and it weaponizes, as everything can be weaponized. And I just wonder if we're at that sort of middle ground point with things like online dating, I've brought it back up, where maybe in 30, 40 years time, that kind of will move more towards the capacity to find a soulmate. As in the sense that we've opened up the pool of people we can choose from now with Tinder. You know, you can set with online dating, you can set your radius to 10 miles or 50 miles. And maybe we're in the middle ground between town workplace dating, low resolution online dating, and then perfect matchmaking in maybe it'll be 100 years time. I don't know, but that wasn't a question. That was just a thing that I just thought I'd put out there because it just came to me. I thought it was quite interesting.
You know what? I'm just going to add to it before like you ask any more questions, because I think it is so blooming interesting. One thing that I feel a lot of resistance about when you talk about that is it looks at science and it looks at your biology and DNA, all that. But one major factor that it doesn't take into consideration is the psyche and also the experiences that we have, that, you know, nature and nurture experiences, the traumas that we've experienced, the way we relate based on our upbringing. And so the first thing I think is it takes away our humanness because it takes away our autonomy to decide.
Yes. Very true. Exactly. Like, and that was what
it's
the controversy
really
was surrounded by. So yeah, it is. So let's go back to the psyche bit, because that's a really interesting thing. Have you heard of Carl Jung?
Of course.
The psychologist. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So, you know, he talks about the anima and the animus.
Yes.
Do you know that? Okay, so I was just wondering, because I just think that sort of, when you mentioned psyche, it just made me think of that. The anima being the feminine aspect of the male psyche, and the animus being the masculine aspect of the masculine aspect of the female psyche. And his belief was that these archetypes were programmed through our childhood and our upbringing, and then a lot of it was a projection as a result of our parents, and then as we reached a certain age, we moved the projection onto romantic interests. And do you find people going for people that are similar to their parents some of the time?
It's a really big premise of what my couple's work is based on. It's the idea that we choose the partners that we choose in order to complete childhood. That's really in layman's terms. But we sit in comfort zones around what's familiar. And often we talk about dating patterns and relationship patterns, and we humans get stuck sometimes in our patterns because we follow what is familiar because there's comfort in that. We kind of know how it's going to go. And when I do my work with couples, it's looking at the different parts that have attracted them to their partner are the very same parts that activate them. So we're attracted before this symbiosis occurs, where we feel this oneness. We're attracted to people that have the differences that spark an aliveness in us, something that we want more of, and we find it aspirational and it's attractive, and it's like the eroticism of desire. You know, much of what Esther Perel talks about is from the differences in another person. Those differences can sometimes be aspects of us, aspects of our parents that we didn't take with us, and we're trying to complete childhood in a way. So there's a lot to say on that, and I do believe it to be true. And aside from like the psychology and the theoretical models, and there's many around relationships and attachment, is what I talk about in my coaching work is the masculine and the feminine energy. So actually, I was just talking about it last night, and I was talking about the masculine's need to be free whilst the feminine needs to be loved. And that is not gender specific. It's an energy within us. And very similar to what Carl talks about. Yes.
So I'm going to put something up on my Instagram of a scene in Snow White right at the end. So Snow White, she falls, I don't know, I can't remember why. Oh yeah, she eats the apple, doesn't she? So she eats the apple and she becomes unconscious, and everyone thinks that she's dead, and all the dwarfs and the forest creatures think that she's dead. And then the prince comes along and kisses her, and she awakens, and people take that as they take everything nowadays, unfortunately, manifestation of the so-called oppressive patriarchy. But that's not what it actually means. What it means is that femininity needs masculinity to awaken, in the same way that masculinity needs femininity to awaken. And the example of masculinity needing femininity to awaken is in Sleeping Beauty, when the prince has to defeat the dragon, which is the dragon of chaos being feminine. So he has to slay the dragon of chaos in order to get access to the woman, and or prince, whatever her name is, the princess. So I think we're running into multiple problems in society nowadays based on exactly what you just said, this association with men and women, with masculine and femininity. So yeah, that's a really interesting point that you're interested in masculinity and femininity, because I agree.
Yeah. And actually, just what's come up for me as you're, you know, as we're talking about this, another really great, interesting and important topic is that at the very start of our conversation, I was talking about the intricacies and also the difficulties, the more women are super duper capable, as they should be, in the world to do everything for themselves, financially and otherwise, and men feeling that they're losing their place in heteronormative relationships because they don't know how to be. And so welcome the rise of awareness around masculine and feminine energy and also doing the inner work. And so what came up for me is that if I had to put a stat on it, close to 85%, I'd say, of the women that come to me are in really high-flying jobs, super amazing. Oh my gosh, gorgeous, so bright, so successful.
Intimidating at every level.
And then what they really want when it comes to heterosexual relationships is to learn how to soften, learn how to attract. If they've not done the work, they might call him an alpha. They might say, I'm looking to attract an alpha male. But what they mean is, I don't know how to step out of my masculine energy, embrace my feminine, to welcome a man that brings polarity and duality into my life. Really interesting.
This is what the feminists don't understand about being incredibly successful as a woman, is that the more successful you are as a woman, the higher level of success you want as a man, because women don't want to date down, they want to date up. So if a woman earns 100k, she doesn't want to date someone who earns 40k or 60k, she wants to date someone who earns more. In the same sense, if you said there's a woman who's 6'2" and she's struggling to find a partner, you'd say because she's 6'2" and she doesn't want to date someone who's 5'10", she wants to date someone who's a little bit taller than her. So if men date down and women date up, so all that happens when a woman moves up the hierarchy of financial prowess is that her pool of men to choose from goes down. So when the people that are coming to you saying that they want an alpha, they basically just want someone who earns more than them. But if you earn a lot of money, there aren't very many people who earn more than you. And you're right, it is. We've reached a point.
I was going to say, it's not just about money. These women are absolutely bossing it. They're leaders in their life. And the one thing they haven't been able to actualize, and it's the only thing, is love. And so, yes, we're talking about a super duper small pool of men if we look at money and if we look at height. But if we're also going to look at a man that is not intimidated, has done the work, so he's in a healthy masculine, as well as embracing, providing the polarity in that relationship, who they're also looking for a man who is comfortable with taking a leadership role above, even more so, an exceptionally capable woman who's opinionated, well-traveled, got a lot to say about herself, has had a lot of life experience, and is ultimately a doer, a planner, a scheduler. And so it's like, where is the room for that man, even if I had the right fit for each one? It's really interesting. It's not just about money. I just had to say that.
No, okay. No, yeah. Money was the sort of preeminent one, but it was just any example of more dominance. I think any example of the capacity to meet more dominant women. I think in the stereotypically, I guess, and sexually, women can often prefer to be more submissive, and men and because they like to be in their feminine, you know, whatever that means. But they like to be more well, more feminine, but you are right. So what was your answer to these people, these women? What do you say to them? Because I think
you've just said something super interesting, and I don't want to let it pass us by, is that you mentioned about submission, and the key component in my sexual compatibility company is that these women, all the things that we've mentioned in terms of capability, financially secure, you know, often referring to themselves as very solvent, you know, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to wants in the bedroom, they want to enter subspace. So what I'm seeing in a post-pandemic world where people have had a lot of time to explore their desire, whether it's in workshops or at home because they've had a lot of time on their hands, is that women that are bossing it in that way, the majority of the time are subbing it in the bedroom because it's the only way they can think to create balance.
Absolutely. And that I want to write a blog post about the blonde hair and fake eyelash phenomena, which is sweeping Western society at the moment. The amount of women that I see that have dyed their hair blonde and have got maybe fake eyelashes on. I Googled it. It was estimated that 30% of women. I generally reckon now it's about 50% at least. I think half of women that I see have dyed their hair blonde. And the only reason I can think is because it's another manifestation of what you just put out. Blonde hair is associated with femininity, which is why in all these fairy tales and stuff, and it's associated with youthfulness as well, because often children are born with blonde hair and then it gets darker as they get older. And I think it's another manifestation of what you just spoke about, to be more feminine, because as we're trying to homogenize the sexes, their psyche is kicking out, because the psyche always kicks out. Always looking for a balance. Their psyche kicks out and it goes, and then, you know, they're driven to dye their hair blonde and to get fake eyelashes because they accentuate feminine features. I'm positive that is why, because all women look the same now. I go out and I'm like, I literally saw you yesterday, or I saw you. You know what I mean? I'm making generalizations, but it is more and more common, I think. And I think that is why. It's because we're not allowing women to be their genuine selves that they want to be, because we're putting these societal pressures on them to, it's complicated. I don't know. Maybe it's not societal. Part of it is societal pressures. Part of it is just what's what they want. But I don't know. I just think that I'm very intrigued by that phenomenon. Yeah, but
it sounds like you're exploring an observation that you've made as a man, is what you're seeing.
Yeah.
You know, and I am seeing with the accessibility from qualified and unqualified people providing a lot of aesthetics. Aesthetics used to be wildly expensive and out of reach for the masses. And so those with a lot of disposable income in the likes of New York, LA, Miami, very American, women would take the steps that they thought were necessary to stay a particular way or to look a particular way. And we dropped that for a bit and we embraced the natural. And what I'm seeing now is, with the rise of unqualified professionals that are able to inject things into people's bodies, the amount of women in their 20s, let's say, who do not need an inch of
fake lips being another one.
And do you know what? I think I keep thinking, in 10 years' time, what is everybody's face is going to look like with the amount of unqualified professionals that have punched toxins into their body? Where does it go? That's the thing. If it fades after 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and these women are getting so many top-ups and all of that stuff, and then, you know, then dyeing their hair. I mean, I don't want to go too far down here, but I am genuinely worried about what is in them, who's doing it. So many women do look the same in your average like countryside town, you know, the accessibility to these neurotoxins. And I wonder what is everyone's face is going to look like in 10 years time. I don't know. Absolutely. I can't speak into women dying. I mean, I certainly have highlights and all that kind of stuff done to my hair. I can't really speak into the amount, the percentage of women that have dyed their hair blonde, because genuinely it's not an observation I've made, but I can't speak into what a heterosexual man is looking at, you know, I don't know, or what the stats are, because I haven't done the research. But it's one of those things that now it's in the psyche's awareness, I'll certainly be looking for it.
Yeah, the textbook sort of yellow car thing. Yes, you're spot on. The amount of women that are, and men, to be fair, although I found out the other day that women make up 80% of the consumer market in America. So I thought that was very interesting, which, you know, I guess kind of makes sense. But yeah, the damage that people are doing, and these the backroom sort of treatments that they're getting done, and there's such little regulation on these things because it's so new, I guess.
Well, then I've got a question then. Do you use dating apps? Have you tried to use them?
Yeah.
Does that mean that everyone that you see looks the same as you swipe through, given what you've described?
No, that was a generalization, but I just feel like, you know, it's a few years ago, the female trend was like the Cara Delevingne look, very, very thick eyebrows, thick eye makeup going on, dark hair, fake tan. And now it's more blonde hair, fake eyelashes, fake tan, heavy makeup. So it's definitely not all of them, but there are sort of patterns that, you know, there have always been female beauty standards that are somewhat societally, you know, they sort of spread through the society. But there's a lot of, especially older women, sort of full on dyeing their hair blonde. I see, and that's obviously probably goes back to the desire for youth. But, you know, I don't know. It's I don't want to offend anyone, but I'm just saying what I see, and I'm not saying that it's correct. I'm just wondering, exploring ideas, as we all should be able to do without getting cancelled.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking before. I want to talk about this dating app that doesn't really work, but I don't want to say any names, because then it's like, it's a disclaimer.
No, you can't. You're a professional. I'm just some guy with a podcast. You can't. Or you can, but I wouldn't. Yeah, exactly. Right. This has been an incredible, I've absolutely loved this. This has been phenomenal.
Incredible. Like, and just exploring ideas and, like, you know, just wax lyricaling about what's going on. And I'm obsessed with dating and relating. So every time you're talking about something, I'm like, well, what does that mean for dating now? And what does that mean for how people relate to each other? It's like, if you're attracted to a certain type of person, if they all look the same, does that now mean that you're attracted to everyone? Do you know what I mean? I'm just like, my brain's spinning all sorts of ideas off the back of what you're saying. It's very interesting.
That's what we want. Right. We've gone for 50 minutes. So I'll ask a couple more questions, and then I'll let you get on with helping save the dating world. The podcast is technically about mental health. I don't know if I mentioned that. And it's called the Breaking Point Podcast I'll ask that at the end. How do you think mental health comes into dating, and do you think it's having negative effects, and what do you think the impact of dating is on people's mental health in the modern era? Or is it not something that you have an opinion on?
I have lots of opinions on it, and I'm so pleased that you asked. And
okay.
I think the name of your podcast is incredible. I think, you know, I'm doing my level 5 in psychotherapy at the moment, working with couples and all of that. And I'm massively passionate about people improving and bettering and maintaining good states of mental health, particularly passionate outside of my couples work in working with men who are exploring the betterment of their mental health, and an advocate for pushing men's circles and points of reference for them to go to if they're struggling, because as a society, women have always been encouraged to talk about what's going on for them. In the hunter-gatherer society, women talk about, you know, as, and it's nothing's changed there over the generations. Women talk about what's going on for themselves constantly with each other in forums, exploring it themselves. But for men, it's a, you know, kind of boys don't cry, all of that. And I've just been for years really passionate about helping men as an underrepresented group with access, or, you know, to men's specific mental health. So just to put that out there. And one of the reasons I don't watch the reality TV shows that I briefly mentioned before about dating and relating is because I think they've got a massive responsibility to look after the contestants and also manage the viewers' view on what actually goes on in dating. I think a lot of reality TV shows who have shown contestants trying to find love to win something, and the byproduct of that being a lot of, unfortunately, loss of life due to how they perceive themselves and how that's impacted viewers. I think even they say, you know, don't believe everything you see on TV is the disclaimer at the end. It's that, well, then all the magazines write about it, and then social media chimes in constantly on it. And I think the rise of TV shows relative to dating and relating and making marriage look instant, you know, love is whatever, marriage at whatever. I'm just like, win £50,000 if you find your person and stay with them, and but actually just tell people that you no longer vibe them, and so you dump them on live on TV and you swipe left of them, and then the backlash of that. I just think the way dating is represented today, outside of the offline human meeting that I'm an advocate for in matchmaking and events and the human aspect of it, I think online dating apps and reality TV shows have been a massive contributing factor to the decline of how people see themselves and their self-worth based on people being able to swipe left. Like, yeah, I get it, autonomy of choice and all of that, but why, if they understand what goes on for people and how it is potentially contributing to the decline of mental health in recent years for singles, why aren't they doing something about it? Having relationship therapists, dating coaches, just have blogs out there that they put in as profiles. Here's how to overcome rejection. Here's what to do if you're feeling low because somebody ghosted you. You know, just like little things like see rejection as redirection. Even if it was positive affirmations or little mantras to help ingrain it into the mind as people are swiping through profiles, I am sure that would contribute positively to people's mental health. And I think modern dating and the way people treat each other as disposable, with this idea that the grass is greener on the other side of the next swipe, you know, people leaving marriages because if it's broke, replace it. Let's not work on fixing it because of the stigma around going to a relationship therapist. I've got a lot to say about the decline of mental health, and I think a lot of platforms could be doing so much more for the world of singles with the decline of mental health. Although the awareness is increasing, there's still a long way to go.
Oh, there's an incredibly long way to go. And I, you know, there's a certain social media platform, which, I mean, there aren't that many, but I'll say once we stop recording, which is just truly atrocious. And the page that everyone is exposed to, is just, it's a, they've been obviously gravitated towards the lowest common denominator, which is sex, and in particular what they call in the film industry male gaze, so male sexuality, which is clearly what is going on. But I think we've social media and things like that, they promote narcissistic behavior, and you're rewarded for narcissistic behavior. And when that sort of, but prior to social media, I believe, not all of it, but you know, the amount of, you know, OnlyFans is something that we haven't spoken about. We could do a whole podcast on.
Oh my gosh, let's do
what I think is. There, let's do a whole podcast on that. Yeah, there's so much to talk about, but OnlyFans is truly, truly atrocious, and I worry. And porn as well. Like, there's a stat, I think, you know, porn and social media is, yeah, we could do, I'd love to do another whole podcast with you, because that is a podcast in itself. But I understand that we've gone on an hour.
I think, you know, like sexuality and, you know, I guess the perceived liberation. The
commodification. Perceived, yeah. I like that, yeah. I watched a clip the other day, perceived being the word. I watched a clip the other day about a woman who said that, who was part of the sexual revolution for women in the 60s or 70s. And she said how everyone knew that it was a lie. The sexual revolution was a lie, but they promoted it anyway. And they, it became conflated with the feminist revolution, which clearly was a very admirable revolution. Well, revolution, admirable development. But yeah, the sexual revolution for women has been pretty catastrophically bad, I think, in my opinion. And I think we're only seeing very, very small outcomes. And I think the next 10, 20 years, you know, it's predicted by 2030, 50%+ of women will be single and childless. And it's so accurately well predicted that Wall Street have done, they're telling their clients what to invest in, because the data is so concrete and in theory so reputable. So I don't know, but you know, I just think monogamy is there's a reason why the Christians said no sex before marriage. I'm not saying it's correct, but I think on every single level, I think, you know, for children it's better, for in terms of disease it's better, because promiscuous sex is an incredible propagation device of disease, and I think psychologically it's better as well. So
Ollie, I've got something to tell you, and it's a strong stat. It's my experience, it's my lived experience, and so there'll be lots of people that listen to this that contact me to tell me otherwise, then there'll be some sort of outrage, but I welcome it. 100% of, I'm really saying this into my mic, 100% of those people that have contacted me who have identified as polyamorous or ethically non-monogamous beings, at the end of a conversation or a day or a workshop or a single staycation or a matchmaking program, I've said, but do you truly want monogamy? Or as a preference, if you found somebody who ticked all of the perceived boxes that you have, would you be monogamous? 100% of the time, the answer is yes. And I really do believe, off the back of my lived experience as a professional in the industry, is that the reason people are resorting, whether it doesn't matter what culture they're from or religion they identify as, you know, I think that dating is becoming more difficult, the way that we don't date in a close proximity, geographical, economical circumstances we once did, the fact that society is ever changing and it's becoming more complex and people become more self-aware, so does monogamy. you know, the autonomy to choose and all of that jazz. And so the safer option for people to preserve themselves from hurt or their wants, needs and desires not being met, I believe, is to split up all of the desires that they have on an emotional, sexual, intellectual, joyful, playful level, and get a little bit of each of those things that they want from multiple people. But the result of that is the depletion, I believe, in energy, resources, time, and ultimately they don't get the one thing that they truly want fulfilled, which is a deeply committed relationship with one person. It's my experience.
Final question. What was your, have you had a breaking point? What was your breaking point maybe in your career? Maybe you had an incredible realization where you thought, I suppose, what was your biggest aha moment? Or maybe in your personal life, what was your breaking point in your personal life? I understand that's quite a vague question because the context of the conversation hasn't really been around that. But
yeah, I've had a really colourful and interesting dating and relating journey that I've shared very publicly along the way with, like, you know, on podcasts or in newspapers about my personal experience. But on a personal level, you know, I had a breakup in my mid to late 20s that was really significant. And I deeply loved then. And my partner, who I lived with, had ghosted me and never came home. And it was a really tricky point for me because I've talked about it often and in depth. And I basically thought that that was my forever person. And so I couldn't understand on a visceral level the ghostings that people were experiencing and why it was impacting them so much until I experienced it in what I thought was a committed long-term relationship after a long number of years myself. And the reason it was a massive turning point in my personal life is because it was also a big turning point in my career, where I realized that my identity was really attached to being a dating and relating expert. And I experienced a big bout of depression and low mood after that, because I lost my sense of identity. Because how could I be a dating and relationship expert for other people, couples and singles, if I didn't know what was going on in my own relationship? So it affected me on across the board in my life, and I had to take stock. So I basically stopped working as a matchmaker for a moment, and I had to sit with myself and do the work. And then after a number of years of doing the work, I realized that that experience didn't mean my self-worth was less than. That person's inability to address or communicate what was going on for them, or not be able to, didn't mean anything about me. And that's when I started doing work in the mental health space, because I'd helped myself through therapy and coaching.
Yeah.
And I realized how it could help so many other people. So then I launched a coaching business, and I thought, I'm no longer a matchmaker, I'm a dating coach. But what happened was I managed to help so many people. The byproduct of that is so many people wanted me to restart matchmaking. And doing the work, coming full circle with it, healing my own heart, helping other people heal theirs, brought me back to matchmaking. And I'm now in the most loving, committed, I was going to say friendship then. And the reason I was going to say that, I felt automatic.
No, I read that, yeah.
Is because the person I am in a relationship with, we have a home together, we've got a life plan together. He is my best friend, and he's the biggest advocate and supporter of what I do. He is in the military, and I guess they're not taught to tap into their emotions there. And I'm an empath and very emotional. And we are...
Which makes sense.
We're a balance of that beautiful polarity. And yeah. I feel it. I'm that woman that I spoke of my clients being. I was them, but now I really embrace my feminine. And, you know, I ask him for things even though I don't need them, because I understand, you know, how it all works. And I have my relationship practice for couples. I am with my best friend. And finally, I'm in a place in my life where I realized why it didn't work out with that person. And I see how there is a plan for us. And I'm actually quite a spiritual person. And like, if I just trusted in that greater things were, you know, the best was still yet to come, I would have found more ease with myself sooner. And here I am, multiple dating agencies, loads of marriages and babies and couples reconnected later. And I'm basically in love with my best mate. That's bloody amazing.
Wow. You're doing incredible. That sounds like you are doing incredibly. Fair play to you. That is what we all should aspire to be, to find our own calling that matches us and, you know, we're aligned with and pursue that. And if it helps other people along the way, then all the best. And that's exactly, then even better. And that's exactly what you've done. So, and you've, you know, as you said, you're in love with your best friend, which is what we could all hope and aspire for. So Sarah, thank you so much for talking today. It's been a very long one, but it's been an absolutely brilliant one. I've genuinely loved it. And I am so thankful that you agreed to do this, and I would love to have you back on at some point.
Yeah.
And if I'm ever in London, I will send you a message. And if you have a free time, we could get a coffee or something.
Yeah.
And I will put all your details in the Instagram bio and in the links for everything. And if you could share it, that would be amazing.
Yes.
And yes, thank you so much.
It felt like brilliant. A minute, even That's though amazing. It was the longest chat for you.
I know, it has, isn't it?
It felt like a minute. I loved it.